When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
In the late 1800s, before anybody in rural East Asia had ever heard the name Karl Marx, the Kim family was like any other, a family of hard-working farmers living among a close-knit clan of villagers. The Kims were poor. Their dinners consisted of gruel, with meat and fruit as rare luxuries. The family didn't even own a clock. If anybody wanted to know the time, someone would have to run over to the neighbor's house. The Kims found solace in Christianity and attended church every Sunday. The family also prized education. And around the turn of the century, Kim Il-sung's father, then just a small boy, enrolled in class at a modest one-room schoolhouse topped with a thatched roof. The young Kim was the class monitor, something of a teacher's pet. His lecturer, however, was a notorious drunk. Each day, the teacher held court in front of class, swaying back and forth as he drained bottles of wine. He'd frequently finish the glass and point at the young Kim, sending him to fetch more. Kim Il-sung's father meekly obliged. But one day, after class, the young boy spied his teacher walking down the street. The man could barely stand, his legs wobbling as he tried to maintain balance. Suddenly, the teacher swayed forward, his legs unable to keep up, and he tumbled face first into a muddy ditch. The boy blushed in embarrassment. A few days later, as the young Kim sat in class, the teacher pointed in his direction and asked him to make the familiar trip for wine. The customary filial piety extended to teachers, after all. Kim collected his instructor's money and slipped out for the market. But Kim couldn't shake the shameful image of his drunken teacher lying on the ground, face soaked in mud. And then an idea. He gripped his teacher's bottle and heaved it against a rock. Shards of glass burst over the dirt. The boy returned to class, broken bottle in hand, clothing stained with wine, gasping for air, and told the teacher an elaborate story about how he had been chased by a tiger. He had run for his life and tripped, shattering the bottle. The teacher listened with horror. This time, he turned red in shame. Later that day, the young Kim returned home and told his father what had happened. The family elder listened to his son's story and nodded in pride. Then he leaned forward and said something that would cement itself into North Korean lore.
일상아, 선생이란 말이지. If pupils peep into their teacher's private life frequently, they lose their awe of him. The teacher must give his pupils a firm belief that their teacher neither eats nor urinates. Only then can he maintain his authority at school. So teachers should set up a screen and live behind it.
Set up a screen and live behind it. Years later, the young Kim would share that advice with his own son, Kim Il-sung. The future supreme leader would find the anecdote so stirring, so wise, that he'd include it in his official memoirs. Its lessons would become central to his philosophy on life and leadership. Today, the story of the teacher still serves as a model for the Kim family. If an authority wants to maintain his grip on power, his divine, God-given right to rule over others, then he must find a way to hide all faults. Anyone who compromises or desecrates that carefully calibrated image, whether it's a journalist or a movie made by Sony, or even your own son, is threatening to do more than merely damage a man's ego. They challenge the very structure, the very foundation of authority itself. The screen, in other words, must be protected at all costs. I'm Eden Lee, and in this episode, we explore the extreme lengths the North Korean regime will go to protect its image, and how the country's obsession with that very image led not only to its downfall, but to Kim Jong-nam's as well.
What the North Korean regime did is they really emphasized Koreanness. They said, we are going to be the most Korean of the two Koreas.
These people would be publicly executed and their families sent to labor in central political detention facilities.
Many North Korean defectors say the leadership, it's like the sun. You don't want to get too close because you'll burn. You don't want to get too far because you'll be freezing. And he was too close and was scorched by it.
This is Big Brother. After the Tokyo Disneyland incident, pundits went wild with speculation.
Kim Jong-nam, who is being groomed to inherit North Korea's communist dynasty, was unceremoniously kicked out of Japan yesterday after he tried to sneak into the country with his family for a trip to Tokyo Disneyland.
It was 2001. This was one of the first times a member of North Korea's royal family had been seen outside the country, in public. Journalists flocked to Tokyo and analysts pored over images, searching for hidden meaning in everything from Kim Jong-nam's gold wristwatch to his trendy round glasses. Years later, analysts would suggest that Kim Jong-nam was kicked out of North Korea and sent to the gambling mecca of Macau, all because of the Tokyo Disneyland incident. It was, after all, an international embarrassment. Here was the son of the world's most famous living communist dictator, trying to cross international borders to visit what is probably the most unabashedly capitalist organization on the planet. But many experts we interviewed, including the North Korea watcher Michael Madden, think these pundits are wrong.
It's an easier narrative, I think, for some people
to say that Kim Jong-nam was the successor, and because he happened to want to go to Tokyo Disney Resort with his family in 2001, well, lo and behold, he got passed over for succession. And that's just not true.
Why? Well, because the Kims are, frankly, hypocrites. The royal family has been visiting Disney resorts for decades. Years before the incident, Kim Jong-un and his mother went to Tokyo to ride those same teacups. Nor was Kim Jong-nam exiled for using a fake Dominican passport. Kim Jong-un and his immediate family routinely use fake Brazilian passports to travel abroad all the time. So did the rest of the family. Kim Jong-il wasn't angry that his son went to Japan or that he wanted to go to Disney. He was angry that his son got caught. Kim Jong-il was obsessed with the family's privacy. He sincerely felt that his legitimacy depended on maintaining the so-called screen. In fact, most North Koreans didn't even know the dear leader had children at all. The fact that Kim Jong-nam attracted so much attention to himself did more than puncture the all-powerful, very private world of Kim Jong-il. It had broken precedent. Kim children, historically, were neither seen nor heard. But Kim Jong-nam had drawn attention to himself and had essentially snubbed the leader. This put the entire system at risk. And that's because the Kim regime controls the flow of information. Every radio, every television must be registered with the police and can only pick up domestic state-sponsored channels. Loudspeakers are sprinkled across cities and towns, playing patriotic hymns every morning and relaying public service announcements. Of course, activists outside of the country try to break through this wall of propaganda. That's why the 38th parallel, the line separating North and South Korea, see some of the most intense radio jamming activity in the world. In 2001, as news agencies buzzed about Kim Jong-nam's deportation, Kim Jong-il could do little more than cross his fingers and hope this barricade of propaganda would hold. In other words, the Tokyo Disneyland incident created a lot of unnecessary stress for Kim Jong-nam's father. But was that the reason he was passed over as successor? Was that why he was kicked out of the country? Maybe. But there's another theory. Because a few years earlier, the people who had raised Kim Jong-nam had done the unthinkable. And then he began having ideas that not only threatened the stability of the regime, it threatened the life of his father. In the early 1990s, just as Kim Jong-nam was gaining prominence in the regime, residence number 15 was in turmoil. All over, members of Jongnam's family were defecting at an alarming rate. The exodus started in 1982 when Kim's cousin, Lee Han-yong, had been studying in Switzerland. One day, the cousin made a fateful call to the South Korean embassy and asked for asylum. According to Dr. Sung-yoon Lee, he would do everything to hide from the regime.
This person changed his name, underwent cosmetic surgery so that he would not be recognized by North Korean spies and the North Korean state.
Back in Pyongyang, news of Lee's defection became a closely guarded secret. A member of the royal family defecting to the South? It was an embarrassing disgrace, the kind that could stain Kim Jong-il's reputation. Problem was, Lee did not keep a low profile. By the 90s, he was struggling to make money. So he began leaking news to the press, earning an income by telling stories about the regime. He often talked about Kim Jong-nam's mother, who had been exiled to Russia. Lee was also making regular calls to his mother, Kim Jong-nam's aunt. And after just 2 months of conversations, he convinced her to defect as well. And then,
sometime in the mid-1990s, this nephew of Kim Jong-il wrote an expose, a book on the royal family, which embarrassed Kim Jong-il.
Lee published a tell-all book about life behind the palace walls. A book, you should know, that became the source for a lot of palace intrigue you've heard in this podcast. But despite changing his name and his appearance, Lee could not escape the regime's wrath. In 1997, he was standing outside his home when gunshots rang.
He was assassinated by North Korean agents in Seoul just one day before Kim Jong-il's birthday, which is a major national holiday.
News of his murder shocked everybody who had once lived in residence number 15. Lee's mother, who had defected while visiting Geneva a year earlier, went into hiding in the European countryside. Like her son, she too would write a book that embarrassed the regime. In it, she compared palace life to jail.
Even if there were plenty of books, and I could take 12 baths a day and eat all kinds of delicacies, the residence was a prison to me.
To this day, nobody knows where she is, or if she's dead or alive. But the most shocking defection was the escape of Kim Jong-nam's childhood playmate, Lee Nam-ok. In 1992, she fled the country. And in a great risk to her own life, she too wrote a memoir detailing the ins and outs of palace life.
I was terrified of being found and taken back to North Korea, of being taken home in a bag. I would have preferred to be killed on the spot rather than suffer a life in the mines or the countryside.
By the countryside, she means a prison camp. As far as we know, Lee Nam-ok remains in hiding, probably somewhere in France. Even sleuthing journalists like Anna Fifield have had trouble reaching her.
I was not able to speak with Ri Nam Ok. She declined to talk to me. I did speak to her husband several times, who said to me, you know, she fears for her life. Her cousin, who was really like her brother, has been assassinated. Her own brother had been assassinated in South Korea. So she did not see any benefit to speaking about the North Korean regime in public.
As Ri Nam Ok put in her last public interview,
being exposed means death to our family.
And she's right. In North Korea, having a single defector in your family can leave a deadly stain, one your family cannot escape. And by the late 90s, Kim Jong-nam had at least three.
If you do something that's wrong, your entire family will also pay the price.
That's Dr. Sandra Fahey.
I'm an associate professor at Carleton University.
She's been studying North Korea's human rights abuses for decades. And as she explains, it punishes and prevents defectors in a unique way.
North Korea operates something that others refer to as love abuse. They will take the fact that you care for others and they will use that against you. So you care for your family. And that is a great way to control what you do. So you might want to leave North Korea, but you can't do that. Because if you do, your freedom comes at the cost of the life, sometimes, of others.
In other words, if you defect, your loved ones will get sent to a prison camp. It will also tarnish your entire bloodline, thanks to a caste system invented by Kim Il-sung, the Seongbun system.
I translate it to mean like political ingredients, as if your politics is in your DNA and it's something that you inherit.
The Seongbun is a system of classification. Rather than separating people by economic class, it separates citizens by their loyalty to the regime. And it's treated as natural, as if it's ingrained in your DNA.
This DNA cannot be altered. No amount of bribing, no amount of connections.
Today, a computer database tracks every single person in North Korea, classifying them into 51 different categories, which determine whether they are loyal, wavering, or hostile. Your place within this Seongbun determines everything.
This Seongbun system determines what type of job you can get, what individuals you can marry, where you can live.
And the worst part is, people can do little to change their Seongbun.
Basically, if your family had any connections with the South Koreans, or with the Japanese, the Americans during the Korean War, then you are considered a collaborator, a traitor, suspicious. And of course, your children would inherit this classification too.
Today, most North Koreans live in the terrifying middle zone, classified as wavering. The 20% who are considered hostile are sent straight to re-education camps or to prison camps. Kim Jong-nam was lucky. He was born to the strongest Seongbun possible. But after three close family members, especially those who had raised him as a child, had defected, his Seongbun status was permanently marked by an asterisk. If loyalty was ingrained in DNA, what did that say about Kim Jong-nam? If his family could not be trusted, could anybody trust the prince himself? It appears that in the upper echelons of North Korean society, the answer was no.
I've been trying to get this out for years.
That, again, is Michael Madden, the North Korea watcher. And he claims that in the early 2000s, rumors spread that somebody in the regime was out to get Kim Jong-nam.
First assassination plot
against Kim Jong-nam. The first credible threat on his life was in 2004, okay? And so that basically tells us that there were other North Korean elites that were a threat.
But here's the question. Who were these elites trying to kill Kim Jong-nam? And why? Was it because his trip to Disneyland had jeopardized the so-called screen? Was it because of his family's history of defecting? Or was there another reason, one that might put the whole regime at risk?
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/news. That's LifeLock.com/news to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Kim Il-sung never intended it to be this way. At least, not in the beginning. There was never supposed to be a caste system in North Korea. The DPRK, after all, was supposed to be a class-free utopia. And there was a reason communism was such an attractive option to Koreans in the early 1900s. For centuries, the peninsula was arguably the most class-divided region on the planet. The entire society was divided into hereditary ranks. The land-owning aristocrats, or yangban, on top, the white-collar bureaucrats, or cheongin, in the middle, the peasants and so-called commoners, or changmin and chunmin, near the bottom, and below all that, the baekjang, the untouchables. Thrust into this hierarchy were the nobi, people stuck in what was the world's longest-running system of chattel slavery. In Korea, slavery lasted for more than 1,500 uninterrupted years. By its height in the 1600s, slaves were estimated to make up 30% of the peninsula's population. In 1894, slavery was legally abolished, and the class system in 1896. But culturally, little changed. So you can probably understand why, in the early 20th century, the promise of a classless communist society held such allure. These socialist sympathies were only heightened by a rising tide of nationalism. By the time Kim Il-sung came around, the Korean Peninsula had been colonized and brutalized by Japanese settlers for decades leading up to World War II. The Japanese occupation still stirs resentment in both the North and South.
The Japanese were horrific to Koreans.
That, again, is Dr. Benjamin Young.
They made Koreans learn their non-native language. They made them adopt Japanese name. They made them basically kind of get rid of their Koreanness.
Koreans were forced to worship at Shinto shrines and watched helplessly as the Japanese destroyed thousands of cultural artifacts and historical documents. Native trees and plants were leveled to make room for non-native species. The royal palace in Seoul, which had been erected in the 1300s, was partially destroyed. The human cost was jarring. Nearly 1 million Koreans were sent to Japan and forced into labor. Resistors were executed. Back home, taxes skyrocketed, forcing Korean landowners to give up ancestral land. Japanese settlers swooped in, and by the 1930s, controlled the majority of the country's farmland. Millions of Koreans would be denied basic rights, from rations to meal delivery simply because they had the wrong names. Untold numbers would starve. During World War II, the Imperial Japanese Army would force up to 400,000 Korean girls and women into sex slavery as so-called comfort women. In 1918, when Kim Il-sung was just 6 years old, he saw the brutality of the Japanese occupation firsthand. His father had been arrested and imprisoned for joining a pro-Korean organization. On the day of his father's release, the young Kim waited anxiously outside the prison. His father emerged from the steel gates, his body covered in wounds and bruises. He could barely walk. According to Kim Il-sung's official memoirs, his father vowed to take revenge.
명심하십시오. The enemy must be made to pay for our blood, even if we must die.
Kim Il-sung's father wouldn't be the first or last family member abused in prison. In 1930, one of Kim Il-sung's uncles joined three men and ambushed a Japanese police officer, shooting and killing him. After the murder, the men ran to a family friend in desperation for a place to hide. The friend graciously offered the fugitives a place to lie low as the Japanese searched. But it didn't take much time before the authorities showed up at the door and put the assailants in handcuffs. The men had been duped. The family friend, it turns out, was an informant, a secret agent for the Japanese. As a result, Kim Il-sung's uncle would die in prison at the age of 31. The memory of that one man's betrayal would bake into a young Kim Il-sung's consciousness. And the resulting paranoia, the idea that nobody, not even your closest friends, could ever be trusted, would become a hallmark of the North Korean state. Kim Il-sung put it this way.
Even now, I say that it is good to believe in people, but that it is mistaken to harbor illusions about them.
And that would become the other central part of the Kim family's so-called screen. Kim Il-sung realized that good PR was not enough. He would have to exterminate every untrustworthy element of society, from root to branch, even if that meant his own close friends and family. In 1995, Kim Jong-nam was rising through the ranks of the North Korean regime. Many of his family members had defected to Europe and South Korea. But he stayed home, ever loyal to his father. And then the rains came. The downpour was relentless. One area saw 18 inches of rain in a single day, the equivalent of three Hurricane Katrinas. Coal mines flooded. Water crushed hydroelectric plants. Flooding wiped out nearly 1 million acres of farmland, causing $15 billion in damage. Nearly 2 million tons of grain gone. The next year, in 1996, the rains fell again. And the year after that, like a cruel joke, there was a hellish drought. The result? Famine.
Mass famine in the 1990s exacerbated many of these chronic instability issues. Around 600,000 people died.
Others put the number as high as 2 million people, or 10% of the population. By the late 90s, North Korea plunged into an epic humanitarian crisis. By the famine's peak, the country's gross national product would be cut almost in half. This was not the North Korea Kim Jong-nam's grandfather had imagined. Decades earlier, Kim Il-sung had built up North Korea by riding on a deep resentment of the Japanese and a rising tide of nationalism. He painted his Korea as the real Korea.
But what the North Korean regime did is they really emphasized Koreanness. They said, we are going to actually be the legitimate Korean state. We are going to be the most Korean of the two Koreas.
It helped that Kim Il-sung was a bona fide folk hero, a Korean Davy Crockett. He was born in poverty, a humble church organist who bravely fought the Japanese and climbed the ranks to become one of the fiercest fighters in the rebellion. And the truth is, it made Kim Il-sung immediately popular. Better yet, Kim, being a good communist, promised to give the oppressed Korean underclass land. At the time of his installment, low-class peasants made up 75% of North Korea's population. He gave them land in just 3 weeks. The reform was one of the most abrupt surges of upward mobility in human history. Healthcare and schooling became free and universal. Illiteracy practically vanished. A law upholding the, quote, triple subordination of women was repealed, allowing people to marry outside their traditional class.
The centrally planned economy, it worked for quite a long period of time in North Korea.
When the German-American journalist Bernard Krischer visited North Korea, he was shocked to find well-supported citizens living lives of happy simplicity. He described it as, quote, one big kibbutz.
This is a period that was looked upon quite fondly by many North Koreans because they had their three bowls of rice a day and they had a roof to live under.
After decades of oppression from a foreign power, many North Koreans had experienced a genuine uplift. The economy was roaring too.
In the 1960s, you could say that North Korea's economic output was ahead of South Korea.
North Korea's standard of living would beat South Korea and China for decades. North Korea's gross national product would continue to wallop South Korea until 1978. The country used twice as much energy per capita than the South. Its citizens even consumed more calories per day than those in the South. It helped that North Korea sat on a pile of natural resources, gold, tungsten, iron, and anthracite. Its heavy industry could build top-of-the-line hydroelectric and manufacturing plants. If you could look past the cartoonish propaganda and psychotically sycophantic leader worship, North Korea looked like one of the fastest-growing, most advanced countries in East Asia. But Kim Il-sung's so-called screen could only conceal so much.
A lot of this was also, you know, quite shallow in terms of North Korea's self-reliance and Koreanness because they were receiving huge amounts of developmental aid from the Soviet Union and to a lesser extent China.
North Korea's success was bankrolled by two of the world's largest communist superpowers. And that created issues. Because in the late 1950s, the USSR and China began quarreling about how to move communism forward. Kim Il-sung did not want to be stuck between the two. North Korea had a painful history of colonization, and he didn't want to be pushed around by anybody. So he made a decision. He laid out a new political philosophy, a hodgepodge of Marxism, Leninism, Confucianism, Stalinism, and nationalism that he believed would help North Korea maintain its independence. It was called Juche. It's impossible to overstate just how important Juche was and is to North Korea's approach to, well, everything.
Some say it's really central to how North Korea orients itself in the world.
It's also impossible to overstate how this ideology would cripple the country. Juche meant independence in all matters political, economic, and cultural. And that meant North Korea wouldn't depend on Russia or China for protection. Juche compelled Kim Il-sung to institute a military-first policy, prompting the state to pour endless amounts of money into its military, at the expense of every other institution. Funds that once bolstered the Workers' Party, social programs, or feeding and housing people were redirected into defense. North Korea would eventually allocate an obscene 25% of its GDP into its military. For comparison, the U.S. spends 3.7%. The regime began blowing funds on parades, palaces, and statues. And then...
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
The Berlin Wall fell. And so, too, did any financial support North Korea received from the Soviets. And North Korea got a taste of what self-reliance was really like. And it didn't go down easily. Imports and exports dropped dramatically. The country's oil reserves plummeted. Its ability to make steel practically vanished. The country's once strong chemical industry nearly collapsed. Factories closed, farmland laid to waste. And then, when the rains came, any relics of communism were essentially destroyed.
Socialism became more of rhetoric and a slogan rather than official practices. Underground black markets started to spring up in North Korea.
Years later, the government would remove any mention of communism from its constitution. Juche and military first became the new official guiding principles. And Kim Jong-nam was stuck in the middle of all of it. He was born during and had heard about North Korea's golden age, a time of growth and prosperity. But now, in his 20s, just as he was allowed to explore beyond the walls of his palace prison, he was watching his country at its lowest point. He watched as North Korea starved to death, its industries crumbling, its peaceful farming co-ops breaking down. To Kim Jong-nam, it was obvious. The system was outdated, broken, defunct, and he couldn't stomach it. Kim Jong-nam was tasked with punishing people who were desperately trying to flee the country in search of food. According to Michael Madden, the job required Kim Jong-nam to handpick people for execution.
These people would be publicly executed and their families sent to labor in central political detention facilities. And so Kim Jong-nam, being a member of the family, was a part of that.
But that kind of ruthlessness, that kind of brutality, just wasn't in Kim Jong-nam's DNA.
He just did not have the personality or temperament to do that kind of stuff. I think it kind of broke his heart. If he had political aspirations before, they just sort of surrendered. They kind of died with him having to go through that.
But when Kim Jong-nam looked around his own country, he saw leaders more interested in feeding his dad's personality cult than feeding the people. Kim Jong-nam knew things could be different. China had opened up its economy, so had Vietnam, and both were enjoying rapid growth. So Kim Jong-nam approached his father with a plan. Maybe it was time to reconsider Juche, to reinspect the country's military-first policy. Maybe it was time to open up North Korea. In other words, he was suggesting that his father lift the screen.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
It's unclear what exactly happened next. According to a Hong Kong-based weekly, Kim Jong-nam had been inspired by the reforms he had read about in other communist countries. At a forum, he spelled it out plainly.
My father has asked me to reorganize the state economy somewhat. I think there's no other way to revive the economy than Chinese-style reform and opening. We should first set up corporations, and after that, set up subsidiaries under them. If we bring about such development, would it not lead to capitalism?
It's unclear how his father, Kim Jong-il, reacted to this suggestion, but it appears he responded coldly. Years later, Kim Jong-nam told a Japanese journalist,
I grew further apart from my father because I insisted on reform and market opening and was eventually viewed with suspicion.
In fact, Kim Jong-il began to regret sending his firstborn son to Switzerland. He believed it had contaminated Kim Jong-nam's mind.
And when he felt that I'd turned into a capitalist after living abroad for years, he shortened the overseas education of my brothers and sister.
And that raises new questions. Maybe Kim Jong-nam wasn't passed over for the successorship because he was caught trying to go to an amusement park, or even because his close family had skipped town and spilled family secrets. Was he passed over instead because he wanted to open up the country? The basic fact is that if North Korea ever took Kim Jong-nam's advice to truly open up, regular North Koreans would see life outside their hermit kingdom and realize just how oppressed they really are. If the Kim family ever dropped the screen, the Korean people would discover that they've been fed lies. The economy might rebound, but Kim Jong-il's head? It would be on a pike. In that case, Kim Jong-nam didn't just have a bad idea. He was a threat to the stability of the entire regime. So father and son made an agreement.
His father told him, look, if you can get married, find a wife here in North Korea, then you can leave the country. But when you leave the country, you're going to be loyal to me. And you're going to do favors for me. You're still going to work for me, okay?
And Kim Jong-nam found a home in Macau.
And that's how Kim Jong-nam
ended up where he did, in Macau, with his family. It's because he made an agreement with his father.
But that doesn't mean Kim Jong-nam was powerless. It seems that his father did take up some of his ideas. The country normalized relations with 13 Western European countries. In 2001, Kim Jong-il was quoted in a party newspaper, apparently admitting that change was needed.
Things are not what they used to be in the 1960s, so no one should follow the way people used to do things in the past.
More startling was, in the fall of 2002, Kim Jong-il tried to cordon off a zone of northwest North Korea, near the border of China, to establish an economic zone where North Koreans could practice capitalism. Were those ideas coming from Kim Jong-nam? There's no way to tell. But evidence suggests that although the young prince was no longer living at home, he wasn't living in exile either. The question is, what was he doing? Next time on Big Brother, Kim Jong-nam strikes up a friendship with an unlikely character, laying his cards on the table and his life on the line. Big Brother is a production of School of Humans and iHeartRadio and hosted by me, Eden Lee. Lucas Riley is our writer, co-director, and associate producer. Amelia Brock is our senior producer, co-director, and editor. Executive producers are Virginia Prescott, Brandon Barr, Elsie Crowley, and Jason English. Our fact checker is Aaron Blakemore. Music composed by Jason Todd Shannon and Tune Welders. Original score mix by Vic Stafford. Audio editing by Jesse Neiswanger. Sound design and mix by Harper W. Harris. Audio correction by Josh Fisher. Voice acting by Mark Chung, June Yoon, Mike Coscarelli, Daniel Kim, Sage Kim Gray, Jennifer Sun Bell, and Daniel Sehyung Kim. Special sound credit to Kwama Tu of freesound.org. Special thanks to Ryan Murdoch and Will Pearson. Sound licensed from the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and freesound.org. If you're enjoying the podcast, help us get the word out by leaving a rating in your favorite podcast app. Until next time, I'm Eden Lee.
School of Humans.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.